Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Copper Bowl by George Fielding Elliott. Yuan Li, the Mandarin, leaned back in his rosewood chair. It is written, he said softly, that a good servant is a gift of the gods, whilst a bad one. The tall, powerfully built man standing humbly before the robed figure in the chair bowed thrice, hastily, submissively. Fear glinted in his eyes. Though he was armed, Amor was accounted a brave soldier. He could have broken the little smooth-faced Mandarin across his knee, and yet. 10,000 pardons, beneficent one, he said. I have done all, having regard to your honorable order to slay the man, not nor do him permanent injury. I have done all that I can, but...
But he speaks not, murmured the Mandarin, and you come to me with a tale of failure?
I do not like failures, Captain Wang. The Mandarin toyed with a little paper knife on the low table beside him. Wang shuddered.
Well, no matter for this time, the Mandarin said after a moment. Wang breathed a sigh of most heartfelt relief, and the Mandarin smiled softly, fleetingly.
Still, he went on, your task has yet to be accomplished. We have the man. He has the information we require. Surely, some way may be found. The servant has failed. Now the master must try his hand. Bring the man to me. Wang bowed low and departed with considerable haste. The Mandarin sat silent for a moment, looking across the wide, sunlit room at a pair of singing birds in a wicker cage hanging in the further window. Presently he nodded, one short, satisfied nod, and struck a little silver bell which stood on its beautifully inlaid table. Instantly, a white-robed, silent-footed servant entered and stood with bowed head, awaiting his master's pleasure. To him, Yuan Li gave certain swift, incisive orders. The white-robed one had scarcely parted when Wang, captain of the Mandarin's guard, re-entered the spacious apartment. The prisoner benevolent, he announced. The Mandarin made a slight motion with his slender hand. Wang barked an order, and there entered between two heavily muscled, half-naked guardsmen a short, sturdily built man, barefoot, clad only in tattered shirt and khaki trousers, but with fearless blue eyes, looking straight at Yuan Li under the tousled masses of his blonde hair. A white man.
Ah, said Yuan Li, in his calm way, speaking faultless French.
The excellent Lieutenant Fournet. Still obstinate? Fournet cursed him earnestly in French and three different Chinese dialects.
You'll pay for this, Yuan Li, he wound up. Don't think, you filthy brutes, can try the knuckle torture and their other devil's tricks on a French officer and get away with it.
Yuan Li toyed with his paper knife, smiling. You threaten me, Lieutenant Fournet, he answered, yet your threats are but as rose petals wafted away on the morning breeze. Unless you return to your post to make your report.
Why, damn you, answered the prisoner. You needn't try that sort of thing. You know better than to kill me. My commandant is perfectly aware of my movements. He'll be knocking on your door with a company of the Legion at his back if I don't show up by tomorrow at Reveille.
Yuan Li smiled again. Doubtless, and yet, we still have the better part of the day before us, he said. Much may be accomplished in an afternoon and evening.
Fournet swore again. You can torture me, and be damned, he answered. I know, and you know, that you don't dare to kill me, or to injure me so that I can't get back to Fort Deschamps. For the rest, do your worst, you yellow-skinned brute.
A challenge, the Mandarin exclaimed, and I, Lieutenant Fournet, pick up your glove. Look, you. What I require from you is the strength and location of your outpost on the Mifang River, so that your cursed bandits,
whose murders and lootings keep you here in luxury, can rush the outpost some dark night and open the river route for their boats, Fournet cut in. I know you, Yuan Li, and I know your trade, Mandarin of Thieves. The military governor of Tonkin sent a battalion of the Foreign Legion here to deal with such as you and to restore peace and order on the frontier, not to yield to childish threats. That is not the Legion's way, and you should know it. The best thing you can do is to send in your submission, or I can assure you that within a fortnight, your head will be rotting over the north gate of Hanoi, as a warning to others who might follow your example. The Mandarin's smile never altered, though well he knew that this was no idle threat. With Tonkinese triolers, even with colonial infantry, he could make some sort of headway. But these thrice accursed legionnaires were devils from the very pit itself. He, Yuan Li, who had ruled as king in the valley of the Meifeng, to whom half a Chinese province and many a square mile of French Tonkin had paid tribute humbly, felt his throne of power tottering beneath him. But one hope remained. Down the river, beyond the French outpost, were boats filled with men and with the loot of a dozen villages, the most successful raiding party he had ever sent out. Let these boats come through. Let him have back his men. And they were his best. Get his hands on the loot. Perhaps something might be done. Gold, jewels, jade. And though the soldiers of France were terrible, there were in Hanoi certain civilian officials not wholly indifferent to these things. But on the banks of the Meifeng, as though they knew his hopes, the Foreign Legion had established an outpost. He must know exactly where. He must know exactly how strong. For till this rear post was gone, the boats could never reach him. And now Lieutenant Fournet, staff officer to the commandant, had fallen into his hands. All night his torturers had reasoned with a stubborn young Norman, and all morning they had never left for a minute. They had marked him in no way, no broken bones, no so much as a cut or bruised skin. Yet there are ways. Fournet shuddered all over at the thought of what he had gone through, the age-long night and morning. To Fournet, his duty came first. To Yuan Li, it was life or death that Fournet should speak, and he had taken measures which now marched to their fulfillment. He dared not go to extremes with Fournet, nor yet could French justice connect the Mandarin Yuan Li with the bandits of the Meifeng. They might suspect, but they could not prove, and an outrage such as the killing or maiming of a French officer in his own palace was more than Yuan Li dared essay. He walked on thin ice, indeed, those summer days, and walked warily. Yet, he had taken measures. My head is still securely on my shoulders, he replied to Fournet. I do not think it will decorate your gate spikes. So, you will not speak? Certainly not. Lieutenant Fournet's words were as firm as his jaw. Ah, but you will. Wang. Magnanimous. Four more guards. Make the prisoner secure. Wang clapped his hands. Instantly, four additional half-naked men sprang into the room, two falling on their knees, seized Fournet around the legs, another threw his corded arms around the lieutenant's waist, another stood by, club in hand, as a reserve in case of what? The two original guards still retained their clutch on Fournet's arm. Now, in the grip of those sinewy hands, he was held immovably, utterly helpless, a living statue. Yuan Li the Mandarin smiled again. One who did not know him would have thought his smile held an infinite tenderness, a divine compassion. He touched the bell at his side. Instantly, in the further doorway appeared two servants, conducting a veiled figure, a woman shrouded in a dark drapery. A word from Yuan Li, rough hands tore the veils aside. And there stood drooping between the impassive servants a vision of loveliness, a girl scarce out of her teens, dark-haired, slender, with the great appealing brown eyes of a fawn, eyes which widened suddenly as they rested on Lieutenant Fournet. Lily! Exclaimed Fournet, and his five guards had their hands full to hold him as he struggled to be free. You fiend! He spat at Yuan Li. If I hear of this girl's head is touched by the Holy Virgin of Vito, I will roast you alive in the flames of your own palace. My God, Lily, how...
Quite simply, my dear lieutenant, the Mandarin's silky voice interrupted. We knew, of course, every house servant in North Tonkin is a spy of mine, that he had conceived an affection for this woman. And when I heard you were proving obdurate under the little attention of my men, I thought it well to send for her. Her father's bungalow is far from the post. Indeed, it is in Chinese and not French territory, as you know, and the task was not a difficult one. And now, Andre, Andre, the girl was crying, struggling in her turn with the servants. Save me, Andre, these beasts.
Have no fear, Lily, Andre Fournet replied. They dare not harm you any more than they dare to kill me. They are bluffing.
But have you considered well, Lieutenant? Asked the Mandarin gently. You, of course, are a French officer, the arm of France, and it is a long and unforgiving arm. I'll be stretched out to seize your murderers. The gods forbid I should set that arm reaching for me and mine. But this girl, ah, that is different.
Different? How is it different?
The girl is a French citizen.
I think not, my good Lieutenant Fournet. She is three-quarters French in blood, true, but her father is half Chinese and is a Chinese subject. She is a resident of China. I think you will find that French justice will not be prepared to avenge her death quite so readily as your own. At any rate, it is a chance I am prepared to take.
Fournet's blood seemed to turn to ice in his veins. The smiling devil was right. Lily, his lovely white Lily, whose only mark of Oriental blood was the rather piquant slant of her great eyes, was not entitled to the protection of the tricolor. God, what a position! Either betray his flag, his regiment, betray his comrades to their deaths, or see his Lily butchered before his eyes.
So now, Lieutenant Fournet, we understand each other?
Yuan Li continued after a brief pause to let the full horror of the situation grip the other soul. I think you will be able to remember the location and strength of that outpost for me.
Now?
Fournet stared at the man in bitter silence, but the words had given the quick-minded Lily a key to the situation, which she had hardly understood at first.
No, no, Andre, she cried. Do not tell him. Better that I should die than that you should be a traitor. See, I am ready.
Fournet threw back his head, his wavering resolution reincarnate.
The girl shames me, he said. Slay her if you must, Yuan Li. And if France will not avenge her, I will. But traitor, I will not be.
I do not think that is your last word, Lieutenant, the Mandarin purred.
Were I to strangle the girl? Yes, perhaps. But first she must cry to you for help. And when you hear her screaming in agony, the woman you love, perhaps, then you will forget these noble heroics.
Again he clapped his hands, and again silent servants glided into the room. One bore a small brazier of glowing charcoal. A second had a little cage of thick wire mesh, inside of which something moved horribly. A third bore a copper bowl with handles on each side, to which was attached a steel band that glittered in the sunlight. The hair rose on the back of Fournet's neck. What horror impended now? Deep within him, some instinct warned him that what was now to follow would be fiendish beyond the mind of mortal man to conceive. The Mandarin's eyes seemed suddenly to glow with infernal fires. Was he in truth man or demon? A sharp word in some Yunnan dialect, unknown to Fournet, and the servants had flung the girl upon her back on the floor, spread-eagled in pitiful helplessness upon a magnificent peacock rug. Another word from the Mandarin's thin lips, and roughly they tore the clothing from the upper half of the girl's body. White and silent she lay upon that splendid rug, her eyes still on Fournet, silent lest words of hers should impair the resolution of the man she loved. Fournet struggled furiously with his guards, but they were five strong men, and they held him fast. Remember, Yuan Li, he panted, you'll pay. Damn your yellow soul. The Mandarin ignored the threats. Proceed, he said to the servants. Know carefully, Monsieur le Lieutenant Fournet, what we are doing. First, you will note the girl's wrists and ankles are lashed to posts and to heavy articles of furniture, suitably placed so that she cannot move. You wonder at the strength of the rope, the number of turns we take to hold so frail a girl. I assure you, they will be required. Under the copper bowl,
I have seen a feeble old man tear his wrist free from an iron chain. The Mandarin paused. The girl was now bound so tightly that she could scarcely move a muscle of her body. Wan Li regarded the arrangements. Well done, he approved. Yet, if she tears any limb free, the man who bound that limb shall have an hour under the bamboo rods. Now, the bowl. Let me see it. He held out a slender hand. Respectfully, a servant handed him the bowl with its dangling band of flexible steel. Fournet, watching with eyes full of dread, saw that the band was fitted with a lock adjustable to various positions. It was like a belt, a girdle. Very well, the Mandarin nodded, turning the thing over and over in his fingers that almost seemed to caress it. But I anticipate, perhaps, the lieutenant and the young lady are not familiar with this little device. Let me explain, or rather, demonstrate. Put the bowl in place, Kan Su. No, just the bowl this time. Another servant, who had started forward, stepped back into his corner. The man addressed, as Kan Su took the bowl, knelt at the side of the girl, passed the steel band under her body, and placed the bowl bottom up on her naked abdomen, tugging at the girdle till the rim of the bowl bit into the soft flesh. Then he snapped the lock fast, holding the bowl thus firmly in place by the locked steel belt attached to its two handles and passing round the girl's waist. He rose, stood silent with folded arms. Fournet felt his flesh crawling with horror, and all this time Lily has said not one word, though the tight girdle, the pressure of the circular rim of the bowl, must have been hurting her cruelly. But now she spoke bravely. "Do not give way, Andre," she said. "I can bear it. It does not hurt. "It does not hurt," the Mandarin echoed the girl's last words. "Well, perhaps not. But we will take it off, notwithstanding. We must be merciful." At his order, the servant removed bowl and girdle. An angry red circle showed on the white skin of the girl's abdomen where the rim had rested. "And still, I do not think you understand, mademoiselle and monsieur," he went on. "For presently we must apply the bolt again. And when we do, under it we will put this." With a swift movement of his arm, he snatched from the servant in the corner of the wire cage and held it up to the sunlight. The eyes of Fournet and Lily fixed themselves upon it in horror, for within, plainly seen now, moved a great gray rat, a whiskered, beady-eyed, restless, scabrous rat, its white, chiseled teeth shining through the mesh. "Dieu de Dieu," breathed Fournet. His mind refused utterly to grasp the full import of the dreadful fate that was to be Lily's. He could only stare at the unquiet rat, stare. "You understand now, I am sure," purred the Mandarin. "The rat under the bowl. Observe the bottom of the bowl. Note the little flange. Here we put the hot charcoal. The copper becomes heated. The heat is overpowering. The rat cannot support it. He has but one means of escape. He gnaws his way out through the lady's body. And now, about that outpost, Lieutenant Fournet."
No,
cried Lily. "They will not do it. They are trying to frighten us. They are human. Men cannot do a thing like that. Be silent, Andre, be silent. Whatever happens, don't let them beat you. Don't let them make a traitor of you. Ah!" And away from the Mandarin, the servant with the bull again approached the half-naked girl. But this time the man with the cage stepped forward also. Deftly he thrust in a hand, avoided the rat's teeth, jerked the struggling vermin out by the scruff of the neck. The bull was placed in position. Fournet fought desperately for freedom. If only he could get one arm clear, snatch a weapon of some sort. Lily gave a sudden little choking cry. The rat had been thrust under the bowl. Click. The steel girdle was made fast, and now they were piling the red-hot charcoal on the upturned bottom of the bowl, while Lily writhed in her bonds as she felt the wiggling, pattering horror of the rat on her bare skin under the bowl of fiends. One of the servants handed a tiny object to the impassive Mandarin. Yuan Li held it up in one hand. It was a little key. "This key, Lieutenant Fournet," he said, "unlocks the steel girdle which holds the bowl in place. It is yours, as a reward for the information I require. Will you not be reasonable? Soon it will be too late." Frenay looked at Lily. The girl was quiet now, had ceased to struggle. Her eyes were open, or he would have thought she had fainted. The charcoal glowed redly on the bottom of the copper bowl, and beneath its carven surface, Frenay could imagine the great gray rat stirring restlessly, turning round and round, seeking escape from the growing heat, at last sinking his teeth in that soft white skin, gnawing, burrowing desperately. God. His duty, his flag, his regiment, France. Young sous-lieutenant Pierre Desjardins, gay young Pierre, and 20 men, to be surprised and massacred horribly, some saved for the torture, by an overwhelming rush of banded devils. Through his treachery, he knew in his heart that he could not do it. He must be strong. He must be firm. If only he might suffer for Lily. Gentle, loving little Lily. Brave little Lily, who had never harmed a soul. Loud and clear through the room, a terrible scream. André, turning in fascinated horror, saw that Lily's body, strained upward in an arc from the rug, was all but tearing asunder the bonds which held it. He saw what he had not before noticed, that a little nick had been broken from one edge of the bowl, and through this nick and across the white surface of the girl's heaving body was running a tiny trickle of blood. The rat was at work. Then something snapped in André's brain. He went mad. With a strength that is given to madmen, he tore loose his right arm from the grip that held it, tore loose and dashed his fist into the face of the guard. The man with the club sprang forward unwarily. The next moment, André had the weapon and was laying about him with berserk fury. Three guards were down before Wang drew his sword and jumped into the fray. Wang was a capable and well-trained soldier. It was cut, thrust, and parry for a moment, steel against wood. Then Wang, borne back before that terrible rush, had the reward of his strategy. The two remaining guards to whom he had signaled and a couple of the servants flung themselves together on Fournet's back and bore him roaring to the floor. The girl screamed again, shattering the coarser sounds of battle. Frenay heard her. Even in his madness, he heard her. And as he heard, a knife hilt and a servant's girdle met his hand. He caught at it, thrust upward savagely. A man howled. The weight on Fournay's back grew less. Blood gushed over his neck and shoulders. He thrust again, rolled clear of the press, and saw a man sobbing out his life from a ripped open throat, while another, with both hands clasped over his groin, writhed in silent agony upon the floor. André Frenay, gathering a knee under him, sprang like a panther straight at the throat of Wang, the captain. Down the two men went, rolling over and over on the floor. Wang's weapons clashed and clattered. A knife rose, dripping blood, and plunged home. With a shout of triumph, André Frenay sprang to his feet, his terrible knife in one hand, Wang's sword in the other. Screaming, the remaining servants fled before that awful figure. Alone, Yuan Li, the Mandarin, faced incarnate vengeance. The key! Hoarsely, Frenay spat out his demand. His reeling brain had room for one thought only. The key, you demon! Yuan Li took a step backward into the embrasured window, through which the jasmine-scented afternoon breeze still floated sweetly. The palace was built on the edge of a cliff. Below that window ledge, the precipice fell sheer 50 feet down to the rocks and shallows of the upper Mifeng. Yuan Li smiled once more, his calm unruffled. "You have beaten me, Frenay," he said, "yet I have beaten you too. I wish you joy of your victory. Here is the key." He held it up in his hand, and as André sprang forward with a shout, Yuan Li turned, took one step to the window ledge, and without another word was gone into space, taking the key with him. Far below, he crashed in red horror on the rocks, and the waters of the turbulent Mifeng closed forever over the key to the copper bowl. Back sprang André, back to Lily's side. The blood ran no more from under the edge of the bowl. Lily lay very still, very cold. Her heart was silent in her tortured breast. André tore vainly at the bowl. The steel girdle tore with bleeding fingers. With broken teeth, madly in vain, he could not move them, and Lily was dead. Or was she? What was that? In her side, a pulse beat strongly and more strongly. Was there still hope? The mad Frenay began chafing her body and arms. Could he revive her? Surely she was not dead. Could not be dead. The pulse still beat. Strange, it beat only in one place. On her soft white side, under her last rib. He kissed her cold and unresponsive lips. When he raised his head, the pulse had ceased to beat. What had been blood was flowing sluggishly. Dark, venous blood flowing in purple horror. And from the midst of it, out of the girl's side, the gray pointed head of the rat was thrust, its muzzle dripping gore, its black eyes glittering beadily at the madman who gibbered and frothed above it. So an hour later, his comrades found André Fournet and Lily, his beloved, the tortured maniac, keening over the tortured dead. But the gray rat, they never found. The Calamander Chest by Joseph Payne Brennan. From the Indies, sir, said the second-hand dealer, pressing his palms together. Genuine calamander wood, a rare goodbye, sir. Well, I'll take it, replied Ernest Max somewhat hesitantly. He had been strolling idly through the antique and second-hand shop when the chest caught his attention. It had a rich exotic look which pleased him. In appearance, the dark brown, black-striped wood resembled ebony, and the chest was quite capacious. It was at least 2 feet wide and 5 feet long, with a depth of nearly 3 feet. When Max learned that the dealer was willing to dispose of it for only $12, he could not resist buying it. What made him hesitate a little was the dealer's initial low price, and quite an obvious pleasure upon completing the transaction. Was that fine-grained wood only an inlay, or did the chest contain some hidden defect? When it was delivered to his room the next day, he could find nothing wrong with it. The calamander wood was solid and sound, and the entire chest appeared to be in fine condition. The lid clicked smoothly into place when lowered, and the big iron key turned readily enough. Feeling quite satisfied with himself, Max carefully polished the dark wood and then slid the chest into an empty corner of his room. The next time he changed his lodgings, the chest would prove invaluable. Meanwhile, it added just the right exotic touch to his rather drab chamber. Several weeks passed, and although he still cast occasional admiring glances at his new possession, it gradually began to recede from his mind. Then one evening, his attention was returned to it in a very startling manner. He was sitting up, reading, late in the evening, when for some reason his eyes lifted from his book, and he looked across the room toward the corner where he had placed the chest. A long white finger protruded from under its lid. He sat motionless, overwhelmed with sudden horror, his eyes riveted on this appalling object. It just hung there, unmoving, a long, pale finger with a heavy knuckle bone and a black nail. After his first shock, Max felt a slow rage kindling within him. The finger had no right to be there. It was unreasonable and idiotic. He resented it bitterly, much as he would have resented the sudden intrusion of an unsavory rumor from down the hall. His peaceful, comfortable evening was ruined by this outrageous manifestation. With an oath, he hurled his book straight at the finger. It disappeared. At least he could no longer see it. Tilting his reading light so that its beam shot across the room, he strode to the chest and flung open the lid. There was nothing inside. Dropping the lid, he picked up his book and returned to the chair. Perhaps he reflected he had been reading too much lately. His eyes and protest might be playing tricks on him. For some time longer, he pretended to read, but at frequent intervals, he lifted his eyes and looked across the room toward the calamander chest. The finger did not appear, and eventually he went to bed. A week passed, and he began to forget about the finger. He stayed out more during the evening and read less, and by the end of a week, he was quite convinced that he had been the victim of nothing more than an odd hallucination brought on by simple eye strain. At length, at the beginning of the second week, deciding that his eyes had had a good rest, he bought some current magazines and made up his mind to spend the evening in his room. Sometime after he took up the first magazine, he glanced over at the chest and saw that all was as it should be. Settling comfortably in his chair, he became absorbed in the magazine and did not put it aside for over an hour. As he finally laid it down and prepared to pick up another, his eyes strayed in the direction of the chest. And there was the finger. It hung there, as before, motionless with its thick knuckle and repulsive black nail. Crowding down an impulse to rush across the room, Max slowly reached over to a small table which stood near his chair and felt for a heavy metal ashtray. As his hand closed on the tray, his eyes never left the finger. Rising very slowly, he began to inch across the room. He was certain that the ashtray, if wielded with force, would effectively crush anything less substantial than itself when it descended upon it. It was made of solid metal, and it possessed a sharp edge. When he was a scant yard away from the chest, the finger disappeared. When he lifted the lid, the chest, as he had expected, was empty. Feeling considerably shaken, he returned to his chair and sat down. Although the finger did not reappear, he could not drive its hideous image out of his mind. Before going to bed, he reluctantly decided that he would get rid of the chest. He was in sound health and his eyes had had a week's rest. Therefore, he reasoned whatever flaw in nature permitted the ugly manifestation rested not with him but with the chest itself. Looking back, he recalled the second-hand dealer's eagerness to sell the chest at a ridiculously low price. The thing must already have had an evil reputation when the antique dealer acquired it. Knowing it, the unscrupulous merchant had readily consented to part with it for a small sum. Max, a practical young man, admitted the possibility of a non-physical explanation only with reluctance, but felt that he was not in a position to debate the matter. The preservation of stable nerves came first, after all other considerations were secondary. Accordingly, on the following day, before leaving for work, he arranged with his landlady to have the chest picked up and carted off to the city dump. He included specific directions that upon arrival, it was to be burned. When he arrived back at his room that evening, however, the first thing that met his gaze was the calamander chest. Furious, he hurried down the hall to his landlady's apartment and demanded an explanation. Why had his orders been ignored? When she was able to get a word in, the patient woman explained that the chest actually had been picked up and carted off to the dump. Upon arrival, however, the man in charge of the dump had assured the men who lugged in the chest that there must be some mistake. Nobody in his right mind, he asserted, would destroy such a beautiful and expensive article. The men must have picked up the wrong one. Surely there must be another left behind, he said, which was the worthless one the owner wanted discarded. The two men who had taken the chest to the dump, not feeling secure in their own minds about the matter and not wishing to make a costly mistake, had returned the chest later in the day. Completely nonplussed by this information, Max muttered an apology to the landlady and went back to his room, where he plopped into a chair and sat staring at the chest. He would, he finally decided, give it one more chance. If nothing further happened, he would keep it. Otherwise, he would take immediate and drastic measures to get rid of it once and for all. Although he had planned to attend a concert that evening, it began to rain shortly after 6 o'clock, and he resigned himself to an evening in his room. Before starting to read, he locked the chest with the iron key and put the key in his pocket. It was absurd that he had not thought of doing so before. This would, he felt, be the decisive test. While he read, he maintained a keen watch on the chest, but nothing happened until well after 11, when he put aside his book for the evening. As he closed the book and started to rise, he looked at the chest, and there was the finger. In appearance, it was unchanged. Instead of hanging slack and motionless, however, it now seemed to be imbued with faint life. It quivered slightly, and it appeared to be making weak attempts to scratch the side of the chest with its long black nail. When he finally summoned up sufficient courage, Max took up the metal ashtray as before and crept across the room. This time he actually had the tray raised to strike before the finger vanished. It seemed to whisk back into the chest. With a wildly thumping heart, Max lifted the lid. Again, the box was empty, but then he remembered the iron key in his pocket, and a new thrill of horror coursed down his spine. The hideous digital apparition had unlocked the chest. Either that, or he was rapidly losing his sanity. Completely unnerved, he locked the chest for a second time and then sat in a chair and watched it until 2 o'clock in the morning. At length, exhausted and deeply shaken, he sought his bed. Before putting out the light, he ascertained that the chest was still locked. As soon as he fell asleep, he experienced a hideous nightmare. He dreamed that a persistent scratching sound woke him up, that he arose, lit a candle, and looked at the chest. The protruding finger showed just under the lid, and this time it was galvanized with an excess of life. It twisted and turned, drum with its thick knuckles scratched frantically with its flat black nail. At length, as if it suddenly became aware of his presence, it became perfectly still, and then very deliberately beckoned for him to approach. Flooded with horror, he nevertheless found himself unable to disobey. Setting down the candle, he slowly crossed the room like an automaton. The monstrous beckoning finger drew him on like some infernal magnet, which attracted human flesh instead of metal. As he reached the chest, the finger darted inside and the lid immediately lifted. Overwhelmed with terror and yet utterly unable to stop himself, he stepped into the chest, sat down, drew his knees up to his chin, and turned onto his side. A second later, the lid slammed shut and he heard the iron key turn in the lock. At this point in the nightmare, he awoke with a ringing scream. He sat up in bed and felt the sweat of fear running down his face. In spite of the nightmare, or because of it, he dared not get up and switch on the light. Instead, he burrowed under the bedclothes and laid wide awake till morning. After he had regained some measure of self-composure, he went out for black coffee and then, instead of reporting to his job, rode across town to the modest home of a truck driver, a mover whom he had hired at various times in the past. After some quite detailed and specific plans had been agreed upon, he paid the mover $10 and departed with a promise to pay him an equal amount when the job was done. After lunch, considerably relieved, he went to work. He entered his room that evening with a confident air, but as soon as he looked around, his heart sank. Contrary to his instructions, the mover had not picked up the chest. It remained in the corner, just where it had been. This time, Max was more depressed than angry. He sought out a telephone and called up the mover. The man was profusely apologetic. His truck had broken down, he explained, just as he was starting out to pick up the chest. The repairs were nearly completed, however, and he would absolutely be out to carry off the chest the first thing in the morning. Since there was nothing else he could do, Max thanked him and hung up. Finding himself unusually reluctant to return to his room, he ate a leisurely dinner at a nearby restaurant and later attended a movie. After the movie, he stopped and had a hot chocolate. It was nearly midnight before he got back to his room. In spite of his nightmare of the previous evening, he found himself looking forward to bed. He had lost almost an entire night's sleep and he was beginning to feel the strain. After assuring himself that the calamander chest was securely locked, he slipped the iron key under his pillow and got into bed. In spite of his uneasiness, he soon fell asleep. Some hours later, he awoke suddenly and sat up. His heart was pounding. For a moment, he was not aware of what had awakened him. Then he heard it. A furious scratching, tapping, thumping sound came from one corner of the room. Trembling violently, he got out of bed, crossed the room, and pressed the button on his reading lamp. Nothing happened. Either the electricity was shut off or the light bulb had burnt out. He pulled open a drawer of the lamp stand and frantically searched for a candle. By the time he found one and applied a match to its wick, the scratching sound had redoubled in intensity. The entire room seemed filled with it. Shuddering, he lifted the candle and started across the room toward the calamander chest. As the wavering light of the candle flickered into the far corner, he saw the finger. It protruded far out of the chest and it was writhing with furious life. It thrummed and twisted, dug at the chest with its horrible black nail, tapped and turned in an absolute frenzy of movement. Suddenly, as he advanced, it became absolutely still. It hung down limp. Engulfed with terror, Max was convinced that it had become aware of his approach and was now watching him. When he was halfway across the room, the finger slowly lifted and deliberately beckoned to him. With a rush of renewed horror, Max remembered the ghastly events of his dream. Yet, as in the nightmare, he found himself utterly unable to disobey the diabolical summons. He went on like a man in trance. Early the next morning, the mover and his assistant were led into Max's room by the landlady. Max had apparently already left for work, but there was no need of his presence since he had already given the mover detailed instructions in regard to the disposal of the chest. The chest, locked but without a key, stood in one corner of the room. The melted wax remains of a candle, burned to the end of its wick, lay nearby. The landlady shook her head. "A good way to burn the house down," she complained. "I'll have to speak to Mr. Max, not like him to be so careless." The mover's burden with a chest paid no attention to her. The assistant growled as they started down the stairs. Must be lined with lead. Never knew a chest so heavy before. Heavy wood, his companion commented shortly, not wishing to waste his breath. Wonder why he's dumping such a good chest? The assistant asked later, as a truck approached an abandoned quarry near the edge of town. The chief mover glanced at him slyly. I guess I know, he said. He bought it of Jason Kinkle, and Kinkle never told him the story on it. But he found out later, I figure, and that's why he's pitching it. The assistant's interest picked up. What's the story? He asked. They drove into the quarry grounds and got out of the truck. Kinkle bought it dirt cheap at an auction, the mover explained, as they lifted out the chest. Auction of old Henry Stubberton's furniture. The assistant's eyes widened as they stared up a steep slope with a chest. You mean the Stubberton they found murdered in a chest? The mover finished for him. This chest. Neither spoke again until they set down the chest at the edge of a steep quarry shaft. Glancing down at the deep water which filled the bottom of the shaft, the mover wiped the sweat from his face. A pretty sight, they say he was. All doubled up and turning black. Seems he wasn't dead when they shut him in, though. They say he must have tried to claw his way out. When they opened the chest, they found one of his fingers jammed up under the lid near the lock. Tried to pick the lock with his fingernail. It looked like. The assistant shuddered. Let's be rid of it, then. It's bad luck, sure. The mover nodded. Take hold and shove. They strained together, and in another second, the calamander chest slipped over the edge of the quarry and hurtled toward the pool of black water far below. There was one terrific splash, and then it sank from sight like a stone. That's good riddance, and another tenner for me, the mover commented. Oddly enough, however, he never collected the tenner, for after that day Mr. Ernest Max dropped completely out of sight. He was never seen or heard of again. The disgruntled mover, never on the best of terms with the police, shrugged off the loss of the tenner and neglected to report the disposal of the chest. And since the landlady had never learned the mover's name, nor where he intended taking the chest, her sparse information was of no help in the search. The police concluded that Max had got into some scrape, changed his name, and effected a permanent change of locale.